Thanks. This is, as always, a collective multi-authored piece. What I want to do is talk today about knowledge circuits and undemocracy. And I'm really coming back at the stuff which Nigel Thrift was writing about knowing capitalism in 2005, you know, the stuff churning between the business schools, the management consultants, and the gurus, but in a much darker, more skeptical way. Because we now, of course, understand that capitalism isn't really working. And it's a kind of lack of knowledge society if we actually add the qualification that we have so many knowledges and so little technical control or political participation. And the thing that's particularly concerned me is not simply the unreformed state of finance 5 years after crisis, but the fact that really there's very little intelligible economic information available on sectors which I've worked on, like railways or supermarkets, which would allow an intelligent citizen in any way to participate in a discussion as to what should be done about the future of the railways or whatever. And I've got two issues that I want to weave together in this discussion of knowledge circuits. The first is the salaried intelligentsia, and the second is neoliberalism. By salaried intelligentsia, I basically mean those who are paid to think and write about business and the economy. And my interest in them is part of a broader interest in stratification, which isn't simply read off the occupational hierarchy. The question of what groups materially have and do becomes important. And I'm going to talk about three fractions or divisions within the salaried intelligentsia: the journalists, the academics, and the suited helpers. And they are, of course, producing different outputs: an 800-word story, a 4-star article, a press release, or whatever. But we're going to come back to them. We're also going to consider neoliberalism. It's a concept that my team has generally avoided using entirely. Indeed, I think if you look for word search in our stuff, neoliberalism would probably barely turn up at all. But that's partly, I think, because if I want to talk about neoliberalism, I'd want to talk about several different moments and disjunctures and contradictions. The three things that I'll be talking about in this presentation are, firstly, neoliberalism as a kind of proselytizing project. What Thatcher and Reagan promised: privatization, marketization, labor flexibilization. The second thing is the Maoist element of neoliberalism, the idea of permanent revolution, because it's never complete. It must go further. So we have structural reform is endless. And there's a third element, which I think is most interesting of all, which is the contradictory undisclosed outcome. If you look at the UK, for example, the main outcome of neoliberalism is massive dependence on the state, one way or another. You can see this in the way in which UK finance, first of all, dumped all its liabilities on the state and is now completely dependent upon quantitative easing, on state policy. And you can also see it in the rise of what we in Cresc have called the parastate. 10% of the UK population, almost as many as work in manufacturing, now work in publicly funded private firms. Nurseries, care homes, outsourcing firms like G4S. Now, that was never part of the prospectus, but it is part of the outcome. And what I want to do in the argument is relate, in a sense, the question of the different fractions of the salaried intelligentsia to the moments of neoliberalism, and look to see what they're doing at various key points. And the argument is broadly, I think, that if you want it on the back of a postcard, that centre-left journalists and right-on academics are really good at denouncing neoliberalism as a project. But when it comes to analysing or resisting the outcomes, they're much less effective. And there's an academic version of this argument in Kresk Working Paper 125, which is really about the infestation of our society by sectoral business elites who control agendas sector by sector. And that's got lots of academic references in it, and it is indeed in many ways a kind of homage to Wright Mills, who I think needs to be rescued from the Millsians. But leave that to one side. I mean, today I want to be more provocative in a kind of op-ed kind of mode and less scholarly. And what I want to argue is that, in a sense, all our salaries in the public university system are a kind of social overhead cost, and we're getting bugger all return as a society on that large social overhead cost. And this is, I think, very much left field, in that it's more in the tradition of Ivan Illich than J.H. Newman or Matthew Arnold, who are the figures who are currently being retreaded by the defenders of the public university. And the structure in three sections. First of all, I'm going to talk about the salaried intelligentsia and the fractions. Then I'm going to talk about knowledge circulation, journalism, the four-star journal, and the uncontested trade narrative. And finally, what next? Reforming the public university and individual practice. And I would begin by saying that I apologise to anybody who's not British, because I'm going to talk entirely about UK processes, because, not because of arrogance, but because one has to engage specifics in this process. And I think if you've got any sense, you can fill in the blanks on parallel processes in other high-income countries. So let's have a look at the salaried intelligentsia, the journalists, the academics, and the suited helpers, all of them, in some sense, as Sukhdev always says, Thatcher's children. Now, there are two classic views of the salaried intelligentsia. The classic view under socialism is that they were absolutely risible jokes, that there's something comic about paying people to be creative. And the classic source of this, of course, is that marvellous Bulgakov novel, The Master and Marguerite. Remember two references in this presentation, Kresk Working Paper 125 and Mikhail Bulgakov, The Master and Marguerite, where it is, of course, partly a satire on the Writers' Union. And you remember in the writer's house on the staircase, there's this poster advertising full-scale creative vacations from 2 weeks story novella to 1 year in which you're going to write a novel or a trilogy. And I've been very struck against this background, how the zeros of socialism seem to have become the heroes of the fight against neoliberalism. We've had a series of books by Collini, Homewood, Friedan and Bailey, all of which are defending the public university as a site of discussion and discovery against Ref Impact, against the Brown Report's marketization, student choice and questionnaires, and all the rest of it. And I thought that, well, there are some elements in their argument, particularly about what the public university should be, that I do respect. I think I want to take a third view, which is the salaried intelligentsia are basically neither heroes nor zeros, but authors of their own careers in a world of massively expanding opportunity from the 1970s onwards. So let's firstly look at the visible elements of the stratum. Business journalists and universities. Now, the first thing you must say is it's stupendous, the scale of business journalism at present. The Economist sells 1.5 million copies a week. The New Statesman sells 25,000 copies a week. Something's happened here. The FT claims to employ more than 600 journalists. Now, that's an inflated total, but it nevertheless gives you some sense of the black glass office contains. From the 80s onwards, a tabloid left newspaper like The Mirror, read on building sites, included a business section every day. And the broadsheets just simply upscaled their coverage. In 1970, 77, The Guardian had one specialist finance and business page a day. By 2007, just before the crisis, it's running 7 pages a day. It's kind of just, wow, growth industry. And it's the same in the universities, because, of course, you're moving from graduating 4% of the cohort to 40% of the cohort. In 1962, at the time of the Robbins Report, the social study department in the UK employed just 7 people. 7 people in the average department, and there were no business schools, because it was only in 1963 that the Franks Report proposed the founding of one in the south and one in the north, LBS and MBS. Manchester University now has more than 400 social scientists and business academics. It includes 55 economists, 30 in finance. And if you actually start to look at this nationally, it's really quite spectacular. If you look at the number of staff who have some obligation to research, i.e. on research contracts or teaching and research contracts, there are 120,000 university staff in that category in the UK. The big battalions are, of course, in medicine, science, etc., but there are nevertheless 16,000 in business and social studies, which is really quite fascinating, because if you compare it with the size of traditional occupational groups, there are in this country 25,000 family doctors and only 11,000 hospital consultants. What I always say is, if the Blairite expansion had continued and was sustainable, we would have been able to put a social scientist into every doctor's surgery in the UK within a very short space of time. And so there's also the shadowy world of the suited helpers. They're the storytelling helpers of the corporates and the think tank helpers of the political classes. One of the really interesting things is that shareholder value and financialization required new intermediaries, PR people who basically pitched to investors. And you also have a reinvention of the trade association, because the trade association under Thatcher is displaced as completely in terms of its traditional role as the trade union. Corporatism is dead. They've got nobody to talk to. But hang on a moment, they've got a new role as private lobbyists and as public tellers of stories about the benefits of the trade. So we have the City of London Corporation, the British Bankers Association, the Association of British Pharmaceutical Industry, the British Retail Consortium, the British Venture Capital Association, and ATOC, all of which, I think, have issued press releases one way or another protesting against our work. This is quite an important kind of slab of people. And then there's also the peculiar notion in Britain of a think tank, which isn't like Brookings, a massive research machine, or the Cato Institute, but whose business is to produce front bench ready policy, which is what, for example, Policy Exchange is doing for the coalition at present. And it's really interesting that it's quite hard to actually know how many of these people there are. I mean, I can guesstimate that there are probably somewhere between 10 and 20,000 business and economic journalists in the UK, if you include the trade journalists on the Meat Trades Journal or whatever. I haven't a clue, except that when you go to a parliamentary committee and business is being grilled, you know, in Portcullis House, where they have those green chairs and Murdoch or Bob Diamond sits at the front, the back of the room is full, not with media people, but with PR advisors, the trade association, and all the rest of it. And you can always tell the journalists from them, because the suited helpers always have much better clothing than the journalists. We don't know how many there are, because there's no requirement for lobbying registration. And on the think tanks, we have no clear accounts of their funding. So this is a shadowy world. But in some ways, I mean, I think what stands out is they're all Thatcher's children, levered off the business and political models of Thatcher. After all, the huge expansion of business journalism was cleared, in a sense, by Murdoch's victory at Warwick. The shareholder value thing required the new intermediaries and extending privilege, which is what both Thatcher and Blair tried to do, of course, meant increasing student numbers. And the results were most spectacularly large scale in the universities because, of course, the other fractions somehow or other had to chip money off a corporate, whereas the universities were chipping money off the state. Scale of this is really fairly jaw-dropping. If you look at the New Labour period, for example, every year under New Labour, expenditure on tertiary education increased in real terms, and the overall result was nearly a doubling to 28 billion. The fraction of the total provided to the state falls gently, but it's still low 40s at the end of the period, with overseas fees as the gravy. At the end of it, if you work out the cost of all the university research days in the British system, the cost is £140 per household, which is, of course, the same as the BBC's licence fee. You know, this is quite a large kind of expenditure. And the other thing that stands out is the enclosed worlds in which all these people live. I mean, one of the things about this stuff about the public universities is people are allowed to reminisce about where they came from and how universities extended opportunities to the working class. I myself come from the public service middle class in South Wales. And in my view, the only thing that ever kept teachers, preachers and doctors honest was their relation to their working class clients. The really interesting thing about these groups is the new groups in the salaried intelligentsia, they all interact very intensively with themselves, but they have no broader relation to a client group. And I think explains a lot of it, even though it also explains why I'm actually married to an academic. Incidentally, this is all as much self-criticism as flagellation as it is an actually a devastating critique of you. And it's a very comfortable world that's created, which it's actually quite hard to reconcile that world with the world that Collini and other people describe. Here, for example, is roughly two-thirds of the academics in UK universities are full-time. Roughly two-thirds of the full-timers are on T&R contracts. In business and social scientists, that's 13,000. There's about 3,000 more on R-only contracts. The average median salary is 45K, which is more than twice the UK salary as a whole. And, you know, even though social science and business is cheap, God, it is cheap compared with medicine or engineering, it's still 232 million, simply if you look at that as the cost of 2 days per week research time. So that's the different fractions of the salaried intelligentsia. I now want to look at knowledge circuits, trade narratives, journalism and the four-star journal. And I want to come back by looking at the moments of neoliberalism. And the central point I want to make to you is that if you distinguish between the permanent revolution and the consolidation of defense of existing gains, which is a very important kind of part of the thing. The permanent revolution really is very kind of invulnerable because it very much depends on financial necessity. The Treasury, with a public expenditure review, can enforce a whole series of things like welfare reform. So that as long as there is no alternative to austerity, which there isn't amongst the mainstream parties, the axeman in the Treasury simply rules. And you don't need lots of knowledge to make that one work. You just send people letters summoning them to come to the Treasury and tell people how much you're going to cut their budget. This is what happens with local government in the UK. You just send them a letter and say it's being cut. But there's an altogether more delicate set of issues around the consolidation of gains in utilities and the parastate, Because, of course, regulators and the public can't be relied upon to see the benefits of what's happened to them. If you look, for example, at the British Public Opinion Survey evidence, what's really striking is that across large areas of the utilities, the public is deeply disenchanted. On every survey that I know of for the last 4 years, 65 to 70% of Brits have favoured renationalisation of the railways. God knows what they mean by renationalisation, but what they mean is they don't want the status quo. And then there's all these kind of much more detailed requirements. The care home sector is completely dependent upon the level of payment from local authorities to sustain occupancy rates and margins. And in other words, there's a constant requirement under neoliberalism, while cuts are being enforced by the Treasury, for contradictory and potentially fragile extensions of corporate welfare. This is, it seems to me, a major point of vulnerability. And it's quite clear that the corporates and the trades realise this. And what they do, essentially, is produce trade narratives which list the many benefits that society gains from having a private trade organised on this, these lines, so that finance will actually tell you about the employment, the exports and the taxes paid by the financial sector. So the train operating companies will boast that the increase in passengers is entirely the result of their adept marketing. They issued a 17-page report arguing that case this week. And the reason for this, of course, is that the primary target is Whitehall and Westminster. I know of no case where a trade has been able to plausibly argue it produces social benefits without breaching competition. I know of no case where that trade has actually lost seriously in terms of the internal politics of Whitehall and Westminster. And it's really interesting because trade narratives are highly contestable. They deal in what the American comedian Stephen Colbert calls truthiness. And truthiness was, it's about weapons of mass destruction originally. It's about, you know, you support, you stand behind not what's the facts and the concepts that are true, but what you want to be true, with a degree of passion and enthusiasm. So the finance sector will say, ah, you know, we pay so much taxes. Hang on a moment, they're saying they pay more than half the taxes, but they're only talking about corporation tax. If, as we did, you then deconstruct it, you'll see that if you look at all the taxes, it's only 13% of taxes paid by the finance sector, whose tax receipts are much smaller than what they've got back from the state as bailouts. The train operating companies endlessly say, we're responsible for turnaround. Branson was taking that line in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago, whereas you can fairly easily say lower track access charges are a huge subsidy. And so truthiness is always fragile. And it's possible to think of several cases where the whole thing has come dramatically unstuck. The classic example is the NGOs like Oxfam going for Big Pharma about AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, which really shredded their reputation. You can have other examples as well. But what's really interesting is the contestable is not contested in the main. And I want now to give you three reasons why contestable truthiness narratives are not contested. The first is the limits of time and space. If you look at the journalists, they have too little time to actually manage to do anything at all. The number of stories you have to file on a national broadsheet newspaper in the UK is quite ridiculous. And the result of that is simply a tendency to copy out the press releases. You know, there's the notorious claim that 80% of newspaper stories are partly or mainly wire stories or PR releases garnished. And what you also have is the social nexus between the specialist business correspondent and the trade and corporate PRs. So that, for example, a month ago, we published a report on railways, which had 70 graphs tables, which for the first time showed how the money ran round the system inside privatised railways and raises major public interest concerns. On the morning it was published, despite the fact that it was sponsored by the TUC, had been released beforehand, and indeed we'd been tortured by ATOC, which had demanded to see the figures beforehand, which is actually quite an interesting comment on how the world works. I don't see their figures before they're published, but they see my figures before I'm published. That on the morning, the FT, of course, has a transport correspondent. He didn't run the TUC report, but he ran a story about Virgin suing Network Rail about unpunctual trains on the West Coast Main Line. And, you know, if the guy gets out of line and starts giving too much coverage to the TUC report, he'll find his supply of stories from the trade PRs dries up very quickly. So the journalists have too little time. The academics are all in little spaces. In my own lifetime, what used to be economics has splintered into many different things. In a mainstream economics department, you've got five or six subspecialisms. You've got all the brands of political and cultural economy. You've got social studies of finance on the side. Now, diversity of opinion is a wonderful thing. But diversity of opinion, when people are only talking to their own small group, is, of course, more or less a recipe for complete ineffectuality. And I think we see an awful lot of that. The second condition of non-contest is, as Julie always argues, the genre output, the fact that the short story is the dominant form of output. You know, the FT's stories are so standardized that it has a manual for how to write different kinds of stories, so the novice PPE graduate can quickly get the hang of what you put into an annual results report. That is actually true. And then, of course, you actually have a bit of cynical commentary in Lex, but that's based simply on somebody swatting up the company or the industry, literally for 3 hours before writing 800 words. It's the English amateur tradition. And that, of course, simply recycles what's in the analysts' reports. And as for the academics, the output is sliced into 8,000-word articles. And everybody knows the trick is how you kind of stretch it, stretch the sausage and slice it into differently angled outputs, which is, you know, it's a brilliant way of eking things out. My grandmother would have approved greatly of the frugality of the procedure, but it's not very good as a way of actually encouraging social insight. You've got the referees as policemen, and then you've got something which probably hasn't struck you at all, which is that in a referable world, where you cannot submit non-standard outputs. In fact, the cost of spending time doing non-standard outputs is very high indeed. When I started off producing public interest reports in the mid-1980s, you could actually put the Aberystwyth report on coal as a chapter in a book and claim it for the 86 RAE. You can no longer do that with the public interest reports. You have to have a completely parallel process of writing two streams of output, which of course means very little public interest work actually gets done. And the third element, really, which is the one which has struck me most as I wander around the world in the last couple of years, is that very much the form of no contest is determined by the way in which knowledge is joining an elite conversation. Now, of course, you realise that at a conference, the thing is to read it from the middle and make the platform within 15 years. But you maybe haven't thought about the world of people like Robert Peston and Stephanie Flanders, who talk to the nation about economics. And their model is the figures come out, They ring three or four people, somebody at the Treasury, Vicky Price, Jonathan Porters, or whatever, and then you speak to the nation. So, you know, the explanation comes from a very small group of people who are telephonable. And there are people who resist this and resist it gloriously. I think of, you know, Paul Mason and Aditya Chakraborty. But, you know, it's against the grain, because the whole elite conversation thing puts a conservative spin on individual ambition. It moves with the group. And then, most comically of all, insiders find that those outside the conversation have nothing interesting to say. Now, things don't stay the same forever, because, of course, the conjuncture moves on. So the conditions of no contest, the journalism, the enclosure in the small worlds, all the rest of that stays the same, but it plays differently. And it's really interesting, post-2008, that we see a massification of knowledge has taken place. So we've got thousands of academics and journalists, but it's elite-led policymaking. If you think of ring fencing and jail for reckless bankers, that's all sorted between elites. And in some ways, it's moved backwards. If you go back to the early 1980s, 364 economists in 1981 wrote a letter to the Times protesting against monetarism. And you now say, who leads the attack against the bankers? Archbishop Duncan Welby. You know, as elite as it's possible to be. And if you look at it, the elite technocrats, Haldane, Turner, have many of the characteristics of people like Beveridge or Keynes. Confidence, curiosity, and an unassailable position within a very small group of people. And the mass of the salaried intelligentsia are, in fact, marginalised. Journalists, it seems to me, since 2008, have essentially faced the problem of events without an organising problematic. I mean, this became most clear in 2012, 2013, when, you know, the right business journalists default onto the market, and the left business journalists like Larry Elliott default onto Keynesianism. And it was clear the Eurozone crisis couldn't be actually understood inside either frame. And in fact, what's happened in journalism is you've encouraged both ends against the middle, because the tabloids have had a great crisis baiting the bankers. And a few elite figures, like Wolfe, who is on the Vickers Commission, have done very nicely, thank you. But this middle-of-the-road analysis is nowhere. And as for the academics, well, it wasn't that they didn't have a problematic. They had too many problematics. And all of them were determined to, after the event, read the crisis, which none of them had anticipated. And it seems to me and I've argued this again in public, that what's really interesting is that instead of thinking, what are the implications of crisis for my knowledge and my practice, what we've actually had is people saying, hey, I could write an article about the crisis using whatever framework I had before 2008. And there's also, I think, a particular problem. I use crisis very loosely. In another lecture, we might actually think about decomposing the idea of crisis. If you think of the whole business of crisis, one of the things is that the crisis moves at a pace which makes academic production look quite silly. Not simply the year or so between submission and publication, but the whole, the elite are all into grant getting, and that essentially involves saying 5 years ago what you're going to be working on today. The only safe way of doing that is to have your object completely defined by a discipline, so that events and the conjuncture are a kind of background noise while you pursue fairness at work or whatever it is turns you on. And I think, therefore, it's extraordinary that after this massification of knowledge, the great expansion of business journalism and academe, what we have, certainly in the area of finance, is the reform process which is elite-dominated in a way which is probably more total than it was in the 60s and the 70s. And I want finally to talk about what next. I want to talk about reforming the public university and reforming individual practice. Firstly, let me talk about failed business models. I talked about the great expansion because I wanted to get your attention. It all, of course, is coming to a juddering halt. In business journalism, the problem is the collapse of the press business model, whereby the ads cover the staff costs. And in universities, the problem is the state's run out of money. And, you know, in a sense, there is a structural inevitability to the Brown Review. Because if you double the cost of the system and the state runs out of money, what's going to happen is the state turns round and says, can't pay, won't pay. Which is really, if you remove the rhetoric from the Brown Review, which is what engages people like Collini, if you remove the rhetoric, it's a structural problem. And, you know, the press is much further down this road than the universities, because the universities, delightfully, are still building, as though they don't realise the game is over. Cranes on every campus you care to think of. The really interesting thing is to walk through the newsroom in the Guardian's headquarters at King's Place. They built themselves a new newsroom right at the end of the boom. And now there are always spare desks there. Because they're losing £50 million a year, and it's one clearance, one selection after another, and an increasing dependence on 27, 28-year-old people, who, of course, are cheap and dispensable. So I think that, you know, it's going to get much less pleasant. I mean, the University of Manchester, for all the time I've worked here, has been a place where it's very difficult to get an office. My prediction would be that in 5 to 7 years' time, it'll be very easy to get an office in this place. Now, at one level, it's a crisis, but it's a large opportunity. And what I've tried to present to you is a kind of circuits analysis, which explains, you know, crucial things, why the contestable isn't contested. And I think the implication about that is we need to think about where to locate knowledge and expertise and how to pay for it. That it's time we sat down and used our minds and thought about where knowledge is located and how we pay for it. And I've come up at the end with three principles, and I think they're a bit lame, but they're the best that I can do. First of all, I think we should stop talking about defending the public university and start thinking about reforming the public university. The starting point was, of course, being provoked by Collini, Homewood, the London Review of Books and all the rest of that, who really provide the trade narrative of the salaried intelligentsia. What Collini is about is how the universities want to be. The argument is that the universities perform and inculcate values that Lord Brown doesn't understand, and that we should defend these against the external enemy. These books are all full of external enemies. Whereas if you follow a circuits analysis, then it seems to me we need to think very hard about how we reform the universities and the media. Because lots of things aren't working. And most importantly, coming back to my theme at the beginning, they're not working in that they're not contributing to democracy in the right mills sense. The genuine public discussion of alternative decisions. That unless you have that, and I'd commend to you Working Paper 125 if you're interested in this, because that is about, it's about the intersection between, you know, the mindset of two of my colleagues, Mick Moran, a political scientist, and John Law, an actor network theorist, about what's gone wrong, that we're a society that's incapable of generating public discussion of alternative decisions. And I think you can envisage, you could sketch a whole series of structural reforms which would lead the fractions of the salaried intelligentsia outside their enclosed spaces. And, of course, what you have to do is resource non-standard things. You have to put money into non-standard things if you want knowledge. You've got to basically stop talking about the Sunday Times Insight team and say, put some bloody resource into it. And I think in the same way, you need to think in a much more divergent way about how you actually have publicly funded reservoirs of expertise. And I don't want to go on about this, but there are very interesting past models, particularly in the agricultural economics department, with a sideways relation to economics and a buffered relation to the trade via the marketing board, which actually, you know, are models of how to, you know, encourage expertise in society. But realistically, I think this isn't going to happen. So if you're not going to get structural reform, I come to individual practice. Because, as Hugh Bynum used to say so marvellously, Carol, this is a petty bourgeois profession. And it always was full of individualist soul traders. And the ref, in a sense, has simply made that many times worse. And what you've ended up with, 4x4s, 100k at Warwick, and all the rest of that kind of stuff. And people, when I raise all of this, say, well, of course, we collaborate with other thinkers in actor network theory, or we collaborate with grant applications. In fact, they mainly collaborate to lever individual advantage. Because in a world of sects and small groups, you need to constitute yourself as a sect and a small group so as to actually get your share of the dibs that are going. And I think that in one sense this is tragic, because I think the individualism was a really good recipe for success for the spiralists who could move round the system. After all, for 30 years and for academics, if you could chew gum, walk in a straight line and publish, you could get promoted fairly easily. And you could move between institutions in a differentiating system. What we now have, of course, is a world where there will be both exiting of individuals and differentiation away from the standard single TNR contract grade. We can talk about that later. And the response, I would say, is you simply, and this comes out of my experience and it comes out of the experience of my co-authors, is that you need to work in teams, not so as to lever advantage in the distributive game, but as to free up time to do non-standard things. That's, I think, the absolutely critical kind of thing I would recommend. Because the key is that by the time people have done all the skivvying around the teaching, and by the time they've written one article a year, and dealt with the complaints that it's not in a 4-star journal, there's, when all that's over and done with, there's no time for anything to be done. And what essentially you need to do is the kind of thing that we've used CRESC for, which is to organise a division of labour so that multiple names appear on the stuff and somebody takes care of task X while somebody else takes task Y. And how should you use non-standard time? I think for two things. Firstly, to produce non-standard outputs for non-academic audiences. I think people should be saying to themselves, how many weeks or months a year do I work for non-academic audiences? And the second thing is people should spend time pro bono, not on research sites, but with organisations, and you can take your pick from NGOs, local government, SMEs, corporates, or whatever. You should try and have some kind of non-research relation with an organization that's struggling with some practical problems. And I think what I would also say is this comes out of experience, but there is no template for this. What we do is we do public interest reports. You might care to do blogs. What we do is regeneration with Enfield Council. You might want to work with an NGO down the road. There is no template, but I think there is something profoundly wrong with an academic profession which is not writing for non-academic audiences or blogging or however we know, communicating with non-academic audiences and not engaged with corporations and civil society. And I really do think that if you want to take one thing away, take that away and think about it. The third point is also, I think, rather different. It's about what we're trying to do. And I'm very much struck here, provoked by people like Wendy Brown and Tony Judt, who, you know, many ways, you know, the finest, really. But what they constantly suggest is we need some kind of high-level knowledge to resist marketization. What Wendy Brown calls a counter-rationality. What Tony Judt talks about as you know, kind of rethinking collectivism. And there's a model, you know, de haut en bas, that we'll come up with a new social theory and, you know, society will gratefully receive it and understand the era of the market is over. I find that completely implausible. Circuits analysis, the kinds of things that I've been suggesting, suggests that mundane, specific knowledge is very important. Because mature neoliberalism is loose-coupled, resilient in crisis, resistant to reform. And in a system which has no centre, but where agendas are locally controlled, they can only be locally challenged with specific. And then I think you can, if you work across sectors, particularly between finance and the real economy, you can begin to understand economy and society in ways which not only reframe society's choices, which is what Brown and Judt are about, but our own contradictory and multiple roles in that society. And I think, for example, what I've come to understand about the economy is that if you work at on a whole series of different sectors, financial and real, is that we've been buying growth by the accumulation of liabilities. It was private debt before 2008, above all housing debt. Since 2008, it's been public liabilities of one sort or another. And I think that kind of perception comes from filiating different kinds of sectoral knowledges. And so, of course, we are social theorists, as Wendy Brown would have us be, and we are victims of managerialism, as all radical management studies people would believe. But also, we are part of the problem. We have mortgages. We did housing equity withdrawal. All the rest of that. It's nice. You take out the money, it turns into a German car, or a kitchen, or a holiday, or education for the kids. And I think in the end, that is very useful, because the most difficult kind of knowledge to obtain is self-knowledge. Thank you very much.